Sorry about
Please
the delay.
Please be seated.
I understand the delay is occasioned by parties wishing to swap witnesses around. I've no problem, provided that we are given a good reason why the witness is not available. And generally speaking, provided also we don't cut across another party's case, though sometimes that's not possible. So when asking to change the schedule, it's really important that you give us the reason. The reason is not that the witness is unavailable. Why? Why? Are they just prioritising a haircut or something more important? You know, like they, in this case, they've got teaching commitments in Christchurch, so that's reasonable. So provide more information, please.
And notice what we got, because I like to reread the evidence before the witness comes on.
Goes, yeah.
So to get a witness for 2 days or something suddenly in the box, I don't think that's very helpful.
Okay, so you are in the box, Ms. Perkins. We need to swear you in. I know you want to produce a summary. Is that best considered as evidence, given that we don't want to confuse you with being an advocate?
I think in this situation, if you just take it as evidence that I'm trying to talk
safest.
About it more as a summary, it's safest, I think, and that's why I thought putting them together was probably the best option.
Yep, no, that sounds like a sensible plan. So we will swear you in. Right. Do you want to do your bit? Thank you.
Right, I'll just bring it. Ms. Perkins, your full name is Claire Rose Perkins.
Yes.
And you are employed as a senior planner and the planning team lead at LandPro Limited.
Yes.
You have prepared a brief of evidence in these proceedings dated 5 February 2021.
Yep.
And you have also prepared some supplementary planning evidence dated 23 March 2021. Are there any amendments that you wish to make to either of those briefs of evidence?
No, there's no corrections.
Okay, and I also believe that you are a signatory to the joint witness statement in relation to planning, dated the 8th of April 2021.
Yes.
So can you please confirm for the court that those three documents are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, they are.
Thank you. I'll leave you for questions.
All right. I think you want to do two things. You've got an opening and you've also got a summary of evidence. So which way do you want to go first?
If I just take you through the opening, that just sets the scene for the clients that we are sort of representing here as well. So if I'll just read through that and you just let me know if there's anything as you go. I present this opening summary as a representative of LandPro Limited, not as a planning expert. This summary is made on behalf of LandPro and other parties. LandPro is a consultancy firm headquartered in Cromwell, Central Otago. We support a significant number of rural landowners and their resource management needs, including preparing applications to replace deemed permits for water take, use and storage, as well as applications for new permits. We have been working with our clients for many years, drafting their applications and assessment of environmental effects and coordinating science investigations of hydrological flows and in-stream ecological values to support these applications. Many of these replacement applications have already been lodged with ORC to balance the timing and spread of their lodgement as preferred by the Council, prior to Plan Change 7 being notified, and several have been granted. Since making our original submission, a number of replacement applications have been lodged. So the expert evidence of myself and Ms. Bright, who you've heard, is being presented on behalf of the following additional Section 274 parties. Ross Naylor, Hortinvest Limited, who manage Deep Creek Fruits Limited Partnership, Knapdale Farms, Lindis Peaks Farming and Terrace Irrigation, Earl and Bernadine Atfield of Waikerikeri Water Users Group, and Mount Earnslaw Station. So further details on those parties is identified in paragraphs 20 to 69. So why did LAMPRO submit on PC7? LAMPRO have invested time and money into submitting on PC7 as we feel strongly about helping shape the outcomes and future of our rural communities, particularly in central Otago. LAMPRO have three key company values: be honest, be your best, and be collaborative. It is these values that help drive this decision. We concluded that given our strong views on the suitability or lack thereof of PC7 as notified, if we did not choose to submit and seek a better outcome for the transition period to a new land and water regional plan, then it would be very difficult to be able to provide the best possible advice to our clients on the best pathway forward now and over the next 5 to 6 years. In addition, as this plan change has been directed straight to the Environment Court rather than initially proceeding through an RMA Schedule 1 process, and as there is no outside funding being provided by clients, including those which we have offered to represent, LAMPRO, as a small business, do not have the financial backing to have instructed legal counsel. The time of our experts, myself and Ms Bright, has been provided at significant lost opportunity cost to the business. As a result of this funding constraint, we have not been able to be present in court throughout the hearing. However, we have been keeping close track of proceedings via the audio and visual recordings remotely and participating in expert witness conferencing as required. We consider that through our participation to date, we have made a tangible contribution to the process. Although it is disappointing that we and other parties have spent substantial time and money to now be back at the point where the 14th of March version of PC7 has become the much simpler procedural plan change as originally recommended by the Minister. Through our participation in the focus group workshop in January 2020, we raised the cost and time issues relating to the ORC's suggested inclusion of environmental considerations and advised that if PC7 was required at all, then it should be a very simple and straightforward rollover, not the detailed version that ended up being notified and we are now having to apply for consents and be processed under. The issues raised by Ms Gilroy and Ms King in their evidence in relation to the substantial amount of information that is required in an application in order to pass the Section 88 test and then further requests under Section 92 are being faced by our team on nearly every application, even where those are for terms of not more than 6 years and which are intended to be a simple rollover. The application process is requiring a substantial amount of information for what is supposed to be a short-term 6-year transition period. ORC consents officers have recently advised that they were considering whether two of the applications we have recently filed for 6-year terms should be rejected under Section 88 due to their view that because there was no substantial hydrology science work undertaken in the subject water bodies, the applications could be considered incomplete. This is contrary to the argument ORC have been putting forward through this hearing to date that this transition time is needed so that ORC themselves can undertake the science work to be included in the Land and Water Regional Plan before a second round of replacement applications can then be submitted. This is supposed to provide for a simple, cost-effective rollover process, which PC7, as notified, is not achieving in practice. So LAMPRO's position, in reference to page 2 of the original submission, but further updated as the court has progressed, the key outcomes that LAMPRO seek are: A, to introduce a simple rule that enables current permits to be effectively exercised as they are currently until a new land and water regional plan is operative. This requires reissued consents to be on the same terms and conditions, aside from historical use limits being used as new limits rather than paper limits, including statutory entitlements, and requires removing the restriction on increases in irrigable areas. Remove from PC7 deemed permits relating to the damming and discharge of water so that these permits can continue to have applications assessed under their current RPW framework, and allow those permit holders willing and able to lodge their replacement applications before October 21 to seek the long-term consents that they need, as many have done already, and have duration considered on their merits.
Just pause there a second. I need to reread B. I didn't quite hear it. Oh, OK, I see where you're getting it.
Sure. Paragraph 18?
Yeah, just slow the pace down.
Sure. In reference to point C above, I attended the recent community meetings for the Cadrona catchment and my colleagues similarly for the Arrow catchment, where the flow and allocation regimes that will be included in the future land and water regional plan were presented. At this meeting, ORC's General Manager, Strategy, Policy and Science advised the attendees that this regime takes into account the community's values and vision for the catchment, including those of Ngarunanga. She also confirmed that no further work, science or otherwise, would be undertaken on this proposed regime prior to the land and water plan being notified. This confirms LAMPRO's view that where there has been substantial work at a catchment scale, longer-term consents may be considered. So I'll then move on to other parties represented and the reason for their submission. Ross Naylor. Mr Naylor's family own two properties in the Manuhirikia Valley that are farmed together. Irrigation occurs on both blocks and is delivered from various sources, including private water takes in the Chatto Creek and Thompson's Creek catchments, as well as irrigation company delivered water delivered from the Omaka Area Irrigation Company. The irrigation water is currently provided under consents due to expire on 1 October through a mixture of deemed and water permits. Significant investment has been made in the last decade on the properties to upgrade the irrigation infrastructure, water storage and water use efficiency. Mr Naylor has engaged Irriteca Otago Limited to design pivot plans for the whole property with water guns in the corners that are set to replace flood irrigation that has been occurring across some parts of the property. Further development of storage on the property has occurred with new storage installed in the 2020-21 irrigation season to increase the storage capacity and therefore increase irrigation reliability on the property and reduce reliance on instantaneous creek flows. These additional operational efficiencies, in particular conversions from flood to spray irrigation, will achieve greater water use efficiency, but developing storage requires significant and long-term capital investment. Mr Naylor has acted in good faith and has been preparing for these renewals for some years, being mindful of the previously well-signalled process and efficiencies that would be required to comply with the existing Aqualink models, and undertaking science work to understand the effects of his abstraction activities on the in-stream ecology and hydrology of the Blackbush, Chandler and Devonshire creeks and as part of the wider Manaherikia catchment process. Efficiency has been his prerogative with his entire financial outlay. He has planned intensively and invested significantly in all his water development. Mr Naylor was advised by the ORC that he had to have everything in place by 2021 and has invested to do that. The upgrades will be completed this year. A significant investment has been made into freshwater fish and habitat value investigations in these waterways. These investigations commenced several years ago on the understanding that applications to replace his permits would be made under the current RPW planning framework, and demonstrating the level of effect on in-stream aquatic values is necessary when seeking a long-term permit to replace them. Subsequently, significant investment has already been made in consultancy, planning and infrastructure. Mr Naylor has recently completed his application in a timely manner, and it is through no fault on his part that the goalposts have now shifted due to resourcing limitations of the ORC that have led to an inability to handle the process despite having known about this looming expiry date for deemed permits for the last 30 years. Mr Naylor requests that a longer-term pathway remains available for those applicants applying to replace consents on a whole-of-sub-catchment or catchment basis, such as the Manaherikia, Chatto and Thompson's catchments, and where appropriate mitigation is proposed based on specific science work. Horton Best.
Need to slow that pace down again.
Sure.
Because we're trying to understand as you go, not just that you're reading it out, but we need to absorb it, understand and check our understanding. So.
Sure.
Yep.
Horton Best Limited are a New Zealand-based horticultural management company who manage Deep Creek Fruits Limited Partnership. They are involved in the purchase, establishment and operation of cherry orchards and packhouses and the marketing of cherries for exports. Water for these orchards is sourced from a variety of sources, including groundwater and surface water, and irrigation schemes, some of which are currently authorised as deemed permits. Some have recently replaced deemed permits or obtained new water permits. An application has recently been made for the replacement of the final deemed permits that were yet to be replaced. Horton Best and other irrigation scheme shareholders have been actively developing consent applications. This has involved significant time and input from consultants and considerable science work. These applications were very well advanced at the time PC7 was notified, in preparation for a lodgement date in late 2020. Water is integral to the operation and development of horticultural businesses, and without water, it would not be possible to produce high-value export crops. As part of the development of new orchards, long-term and secure sources of water are required to give confidence to investors, especially given that it takes approximately 4 years to reach first production of fruit, and a further 3 to 4 years to reach full production capacity of the trees. Significant capital investment has been made in the establishment and operation of these horticultural developments. Typical costs for development until point of first production range from $150,000 per hectare to $200,000 per hectare, depending on the planting method, level of irrigation infrastructure, and whether or not the orchard is to be netted. Significant economic benefits arise from these developments, including employment of between 3 to 4 full-time staff per orchard, and up to 100 full-time equivalents during pruning and harvest. These developments also rely on local supply businesses for the provision of services, irrigation infrastructure, and other orchard-related products such as fertiliser and spray. Where possible, Horton Best endeavour to source locally, which means there is a significant economic flow-on effect to local communities from these horticultural developments. HortInvest are currently looking at further horticultural development opportunities within central Otago, although there is a significant risk that such developments may not occur if PC7 limits access to long-term secure water supplies. HortInvest have significant reservations around whether the OIC has fully considered the economic and social impacts of PC7 and whether they have provided due consideration to alternative options other than PC7. HortInvest request that a longer-term pathway remains available for those applicants applying to replace consents on a whole-of-subcatchment basis. I won't repeat the rest of that, it's the same as what Mr Naylor summarised. Napdale Farms farms 687 hectares in the Omakau-Matakanui area of the Manaherikia Valley is a dairy farm with 750 cows. Irrigation water is provided to the property through private deemed permits from Blackbush Creek and Russell Creek in the Thompson's Creek catchment and through shares in the OAIC. Significant investment has been made to maintain the water take, conveyance, storage and irrigation infrastructure in good working order. Napdale Farms has already invested heavily in water storage to reduce instantaneous reliance on surface water, with six reservoirs or dams constructed in the past 6 years, in addition to the existing two reservoirs present at the time the property was purchased in 2014. Ongoing expenditure will also be required to ensure all of the water infrastructure, especially the reservoirs, are in good working order and water is used as efficiently as possible. The provision of on-farm storage has enabled efficient use of water so that when restrictions on scheme water arise, private water rights can be used to top up storage and enable irrigation to continue during dry periods. Napdale Farms has also spent considerable capital making the farm in general more efficient, productive and environmentally friendly. This has included construction of a state-of-the-art milking shed and effluent management system. Fencing of waterways has occurred and riparian planting is ongoing. In December 2018, Napdale Farms applied to the OIC to replace the existing permits to take water. This application is seeking a consent duration of 35 years for both replacement permits. At the time, OIC had actively encouraged applicants to lodge their application well prior to the expiry of their permits, in order to ensure the application was processed in a timely fashion. Considerable expenditure has since been made in attempts to achieve resolution with OIC and affected parties, with no real progress made some 18 months later. Napdale Farms consider it unfair then to force applicants to spend additional time and cost to participate in PC7 to ensure the voice of farmers and irrigators is heard, and is financially challenging when this plan change would see that Napdale Farms do it all again in 6 years. Like Mr Naylor, Napdale Farms has been preparing for their replacements for some time, being mindful of the efficiency expectations of ORC and the need to undertake robust science work to feed into the sub-catchment and catchment-wide approach. Subsequently, significant investment has already been made in consultancy planning and infrastructure on the farm. Napdale Farms also request that a longer-term pathway remains available. Lindis Peaks and Terraces Irrigation. Lindis Peaks is an approximately 3,500 hectare extensive sheep and beef operation with irrigated finishing country that has recently expanded to include a small area of horticulture. Lindis Peaks has approximately 300 hectares of irrigation, which equates to around 8% of the total land area in irrigation. Whilst proportionally the area of irrigation on Lindis Peaks is very small, it is integral to the success of the farming operations, without which it would not be possible to finish the stock. This irrigation ensures certainty of production in a climatically challenging location, which would otherwise impact on-farm profitability and production capability. Lindis Peaks secures all of its water from the Terraces Irrigation Scheme, and since the scheme started providing water in 2014, Lindis Peaks has been able to improve efficiency and profitability, as well as now being in a position to explore greater on-farm diversification opportunities. Since the establishment of that scheme, Lindis Peaks have progressed with the installation of a series of centre pivot irrigators to now enable the full irrigation of around 300 hectares. In addition to the capital costs associated with pipes, pivots and pumps, there have also been extensive costs associated with installing new stock lanes, new fencing and pasture renewal. On the back of a secure long-term consent for irrigation, Lindis Peaks have taken the opportunity to commit to the development of approximately 80 hectares into cherry orchard. In 2019, approximately 11 hectares of land was planted in trees, A further 20 hectares is planned and was planted in winter 2020, and a final 50 hectares is to be planted in 2021. Terraces Irrigation Limited currently hold permits to abstract groundwater and connected surface water. Both permits authorise the taking of water from the Clutha Mata'au River. Water from both sources is used for irrigation, communal domestic, stock water, firefighting, frost fighting, and industrial use. A transfer application was recently granted to Lindis Peaks to transfer their shares from APL to the TIL, from one location to another, basically, on the Clutha River. But because of the PC7 process, the term of consent was reduced by 19 years to only a 15-year term. Lindis Peaks and Terraces Irrigation share the view that this application should have fallen outside of PC7 and should not be subject to the matters of control set out within PC7, especially where no new water allocation was involved and the abstraction site was on the same water body. Of primary concern to Lindis Peaks with regards to PC7 is the lack of clarity on how PC7 is intended to apply to applications for new water takes, including the proposed transfer of water from one point of take to another. The transfer that has occurred did not propose any change to allocation. Rather, it was only to take the same water from a different location. However, the current way in which PC7 is written and the contradictions between objectives, rules and policies make it unclear how such applications will be processed. Lindis Peaks and Terraces Irrigation consider that PC7 should not apply to transfers of water where there is no new allocation at the proposed transfer and the proposed transfer site is on the same water body. So that it should be end.
So what considerations should apply?
I think just the same considerations that you'd use under the RPW rather than the change in duration. I think that's the duration consideration that was their concern here.
Yeah, so what considerations do apply under the operative water plan?
Whether there is any change in effects at the new location compared to the current location, and whether that key consideration in terms of in-stream ecology, and also whether there's any other users that may be affected in the reach between one point of take and the other, are probably the two key considerations.
And so on that transfer, their longer-term consent was not back?
So they had 34 years left.
Yep.
And they got dropped back to only having 15-year term. So instead of the 34-year term transferring over with the new location, they got knocked back down to a 15-year duration.
Are they going to go with it?
Well, they didn't want to go through another whole hearing process to argue that.
Did they have the option of continuing with their existing consent?
They couldn't access the water for their particular property from that other location.
Oh, okay.
So they had to move it to be able to actually access the
to
water properly.
To get water. Okay. Is that a relevant consideration?
I think it is a relevant consideration. It is something that a few applicants are looking at. We've had talked with a few other current water permit holders that want to make changes, transfer locations in the same aquifer or water body, where this duration argument is coming into play.
And so is that picked up in your, was it picked up in their original submission?
It was picked up in their original submission, yes.
And what was the relief they were looking for?
That I would have to double check, to be honest, exactly how the relief was worded.
And have you picked that relief up in your planning evidence, or weren't you required to?
I hadn't at the time, no.
Okay, but you were acting for them?
Yes.
But you haven't proposed relief?
No, not on that specifically.
Should you have?
Potentially, yes. As I was going through this more over the weekend, it's something that came back to the front of mind of going, well, potentially that is something that we should consider a bit further.
All right. And then at paragraph 54, you talk about new water. What's your problem with new water? I understand the transfer issue.
Yeah, this is Lindis Peaks's request in their submission. So this some of this information is taken directly in terms of representing their view on that. My view as a planning expert is that new water probably should be captured under PC7 in terms of the reflection of duration, because it is falling into that transition period.
Right.
But a transfer is a different scenario.
Okay.
So briefly moving to Earl and Bernadine Atfield in paragraph 57. They, along with two other users, share in two permits to take and use water from Waikerikeri Creek, which is a tributary of the Clutha, which expire in October. Water under these permits is used for irrigation of pasture using a mix of border dike and flood irrigation methods. significant investment has been made to maintain the water tank, conveyance, storage and irrigation infrastructure in good working order, including the construction of a new storage dam and plans for a pipeline that will allow for spray irrigation conversion. An application to replace the deemed and water permits was lodged in 2018, but has stalled as a result of the challenge progressing consultation with iwi to a meaningful resolution. Having prepared and lodged the application some years ago and spent considerable time and money on science work within the catchment, they are now having to spend additional time and cost to participate in PC7 to ensure their voices are heard, which adds additional time and cost. It is incredibly frustrating, considering the time and money spent over the last 3 to 4 years preparing and lodging their application, that they may have to do it all again in 6 years. The Atfields request that longer-term pathway remains available. And lastly is Mount Earnslaw Station. Geoffrey Thompson holds a deemed permit to take and discharge water from Earnslaw Burn for the purpose of hydropower generation, located in the Glenorchy Paradise area. This water services the small hydropower scheme built and constructed in the 1950s to power the surrounding farms. The race delivering water to the hydropower station also provides stock drinking water and domestic water for one dwelling. In February 2020, Mount Earnslaw Trust applied to the ORC to replace the existing water permit prior to PC7 being notified. Water is sourced from the Earnslaw Burn, an alpine glacial fed river feeding Diamond Lake. The abstraction point is low in the catchment due to the steep alpine topography and is the only water permit on that water body. Water is then conveyed through a well-maintained race to the applicant's reservoir where the hydropower station is located. The power plant has been operational since 1958 and was registered in 1962. The powerhouse holds a 20 kilowatt generator but provides approximately 10 to 11 kilowatts of power when generating. Power generation historically provided electricity for the farms within the area and has since continued running for personal use on Mount Earnslaw Station. The power plant is currently independent of the main grid. Mr. Thompson has discussed with an electrician who supported the original development of the power plant regarding sending surplus power to the local grid, of which is possible, and this is being investigated as an option. This is a significant positive of the scheme and of the investment made into the powerhouse in this remote area of Otago that frequently has disruption to the main grid due to severe winters and remoteness. No irrigation is provided by this permit. The primary use is therefore hydropower, stock water and domestic needs. The scheme infrastructure is all in good condition, including the diversion that is well looked after by the applicant, when all water not required for stock or domestic use returning to the same catchment, albeit a little further downstream than where it would naturally flow. Significant investment has been made by Mr. Thompson into understanding the potential impacts of the scheme on the values of the wider Diamond Lake Reserve. Being an alpine catchment, the abstraction is a minor proportion of mean annual low flows. Written approval has been provided to the application by Department of Conservation, and approval from Ōkaha, Te Ao Marama, Fish and Game and Forests and Bird has been discussed in some detail for a possible 10 to 15 year amended consent term prior to being withdrawn as a result of the current PC7 court process. Geoffrey Thompson of Mount Earnslaw requests that water use for hydroelectric generation be considered separately to those permits where irrigation is the primary use, and a simpler process should be in place for this activity. Geoffrey Thompson believes that the current Section 32A report and PC7 lacks a high country perspective. Although PC7 is worded to be relevant to all deemed permits, PC7 does not adequately address the unique situation in this case where the water is used for hydroelectricity generation.
Did you propose relief in your evidence dealing with hydro?
No, I didn't at the time.
Should you?
Originally. Yes, much like the Terrace may come back to those. Yeah.
You may not have a chance. That's, you know.
No, it's more when I came back to them at the purpose of summarising this.
How do you understand the term primary, just as a matter of interest? Like, you say it's 66. There's no irrigation provided by the permit. So the primary use, therefore, is every other use that they've got. Whereas I would have thought primary would have a different meaning. It's at least if the primary use is hydro, and then the permit holder takes water off for stock water and domestic needs, which, you know, depending on reasonable use and effects on environment, is permitted anyway under the Act. Mm-hmm. So how do you understand the term primary?
I would interpret the term primary to be what it is, the main purpose of it, and the majority of the water is used for.
Yes, and so here, what is the majority of the water?
Hydroelectric.
I just wish to be clear because I'm going to be asking the same thing about community water use as well. Okay, thank you. Right. Then you've got a second statement.
Yes, that's much shorter.
Yep.
Zoom through to start at paragraph 3.
Yep.
So this is about timing and approach. I accept that PC7, in my opinion, in some form is needed to provide direction towards the transition to longer-term sustainable management of fresh water via a new land and water regional plan that fully gives effect to the MPSFM, as discussed in paragraph 17 of my supplementary evidence. I consider that the changes to the controlled activity pathway in the 14th of March version better reflect the position I put forward in the original focus group session in January 2020. I probably don't need to repeat that because that's actually in the summary I've just gone through. If we move to paragraph 5. In addition, being able to implement many of the changes required through an environmental approach and not simply a procedural approach are unlikely to be able to be achieved with only a six-year term of consent, as many will require infrastructure and system upgrades on farm. The timing of PC7 compared to the timing of the applications for the majority of the deemed permit replacement applications means that a simple, low-cost process cannot be followed, as applications have had to be made under both the RPW and PC7 in order to meet the timeframes under Section 124 and are therefore complex and costly.
Just pause there a second. I have.
Many of the recent applications outside the larger catchment groups, I or one of my colleagues have lodged for a six-year term, albeit as a non-complying activity as the notified provisions of PC7 cannot be met, have had substantial Section 92 requests from ORC consents officers in relation to providing more information on the hydrology and ecology of the subject water bodies and indicating that they will be recommending residual and or minimum flows. This clearly indicates why the PC7 controlled activity pathway needs to be procedural only in order to achieve a simple, low-cost and appealing pathway. PC7 also undermines the collective and collaborative approach undertaken by many catchment groups and water users across Otago that have been progressing the development of, as far as possible, MPSFM-compliant river flow management regimes for some time. The placeholder consents encouraged by PC7 will prevent any benefits being realised in those catchments for the next at least 6 years. And just briefly on scope, in consideration of the legal submissions of ORC dated 7th of April and the recommendation in my supplementary evidence to include a discretionary activity pathway that allows for some permits to seek a longer term, I have reviewed LAMPRO's submission, which clearly sets out the scope of decisions sought, including, in particular, allowing those permit holders willing and able to lodge their replacement applications before October 2021, to seek the long-term consents that they need, as many have done already, and have duration considered on their merits. I consider that this clearly indicates to any interested parties the relief that is being sought and that the discretionary activity or longer-term approach is a logical consequence of this relief that could be foreseen. The court therefore have jurisdiction to consider this, in my opinion.
It may be that council was getting at something slightly different than whether you made a submission about it. It's whether it's in the scope of the plan changes notified. So you've got both what is the purpose of this plan change as an instrument, as well as, you know, what are folk picking up in terms of their submissions? Are you within scope of both? And it could be that council was saying, well, look, this plan change isn't a plan change about supplanting the water plan Chapter 6, Chapter 12 regime with something in this plan change. It's not about that, so therefore you're outside of scope. So it's a serious question, and you might need to come back to it. Mr. Moore, is that where you were coming from?
To the to the witness, the submissions were not about the land pro submission. They were about the submission, the ORUG submission.
Yeah, so, well, I think that's right, actually.
So insofar as there may be scope within the land pro
within a submission.
Submission for this relief, that may well be the case. Mm. We didn't look at scope in relation to parties that hadn't yet appeared, but we would
And you weren't asked to. So is there scope in terms of the plan change itself, the notified plan change, to be looking at a policy regime for long-term consents, or have you not turned your mind to that?
I haven't really turned my mind to that, although my preliminary view would be, yes, that would be a submission on Plan Change 7. It's a plan change seeking to constrain the duration of permits, so a submission seeking not to have that constraint would still be a submission on Plan Change 7. I'd need to go back and look at this particular submission and see whether there's a logical connection between the passage set out at paragraph 10 and the precise relief which is now being pursued, which I'm not actually clear about yet.
You'll get to in your next question.
Indeed.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Continue.
Sure. So then I finally note the further amendments that I recommend in addition to those that have already been proposed through the 14th of March version and changes made through Attachment 1 to the planner's JWS. So A, there is the limitation on irrigation area from policy 10A21 and rule 10A3.1.1 being removed. B is allowing those permits, as I sort of mentioned a few times, to be able to continue with a longer term pathway where there has been significant work undertaken, and C, that the application of PC7 for deemed permits relating to the damming and discharge of water should be removed.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to hand you over to Mr. Moore now.
Sure. Thank you and good afternoon. I want to start by understanding what I'm to do with your opening representation on behalf of a range of submitters in the context of the question which I'm going to ask you about your planning evidence. Now, just so I'm clear, in terms of your opening presentation, are you professionally engaged by the parties listed at your paragraph 5 to provide planning evidence for them?
Yes, so we prepared the submissions for those parties and then have had discussions with them about whether they wanted to present any evidence themselves, whether they were happy for us, who are providing evidence already, to be effectively presenting that on their behalf as well. So we've had conversations and emails with those parties to say that they are happy for us to take the lead on that for them. They did not want to present anything themselves, so their opening representation is merely a summary of, like you would get from any other farming witness, lay witness, sort of turning up to say this is just basically a summary of their key points from their submission and setting out a perspective for the court as to why it's important for them.
And so each of those submitters has not given evidence?
No.
And insofar as you have put forward in your representation information pertaining to those submitters, are you putting that forward as evidence or something else?
It's not specifically evidence. It's more re-highlighting their submission points effectively. None of that is new. That is all just taken from their submissions directly.
Is it fair to say that what you're doing is you're highlighting their position in terms of the position that they've put forward in their submission?
Yes.
So in a sense you're advocating their position for them?
Yes, effectively that was effectively a bit more of an advocacy statement, which is why I did try to be quite careful with what went into that versus what I considered to be my planning evidence or summaries of what I have stated to date. As I pointed out to the judge, that I hadn't fully taken into consideration some of those points in those submissions in my original planning evidence.
And so when you sit down and you prepare your planning evidence, you say you've complied with the code of conduct for expert witnesses. Yes. And you reread that code
yes.
again, and you understand that as an independent expert witness before this court, you are not to advocate for a client.
Correct.
And yet what you've set out in your opening representation is essentially a set of advocacy statements in relation to parties that your company represents.
Effectively, and that's why this didn't necessarily need to be presented as an expert witness, but it made more sense for questions that may arise from the court that were of a planning nature to be here at the same time for both.
Well, I understand the line you're trying to tread, but it's not as simple as it is simply taking off one hat and putting on another hat as you transition from being an advocate to being an expert planner.
Sure, I appreciate that. Yeah, it may be a blurred line there. It may have come across as a blurred line today for that.
So in relation to the evidence that you've given in your opening representation, are you familiar with the information that you've put forward in this summary? Can you answer questions about that which you've put forward in terms of the factual assumptions underpinning these submissions?
For some of them, yes, because I am familiar with them as a client, as a separate part of the process, but for some of them, I am not any more familiar with them than the information they've provided me with.
So insofar as, well, perhaps let's look at your paragraph 5 of that opening presentation. Which of the entities are you familiar with, and which of the ones have you just summarised what's in the submission?
I'm particularly familiar with Mr Naylor. I prepared his application for the Chateau Creek catchment. For Knapdale Farms, Earl and Bernadine Atfield and Mount Earnshaw Station.
Slow down for a moment, please.
C, E.
So let's do it in order. B, Horton Vest.
No, that I'm not specifically familiar with them.
Yes, Knapdale.
Insofar as I, in my role as team leader, have worked with others in the team who are responsible for it. So not.
So not really.
Not as good. It's like tier two, effectively, of knowledge.
Lindis Peaks.
Not that familiar, no.
Atfield.
Similar to Knapdale Farms. I have some knowledge through others in the team working on that process, their processes.
And Mount Earnslaw.
Same as E. I am familiar with the application, but I have not been involved in the details of their particular consent.
So when we look down that list there, it's only really the Naylor application that you would be able to answer any further questions on in relation to the information that's in this representation.
I could answer some further questions on Knapdale, the Atfields and Mount Earnslaw, but not on Horton Vest or Lindis Peaks.
Your Honour, we're getting close to the end of the day, and I would have a more careful read of some of this information that's been put forward to see whether or not I want to take any further questions in relation to the information in the representation statement. Otherwise, I'm going to transition away from that into some other material, and I may have to circle back to this in the morning.
Ms. Chow had suggested that we need to sit a little bit later in order to get through who we need to get through for tomorrow.
Oh, right.
I'm only going to suggest half an hour more if that's what parties wanted to do.
I would suggest we won't. This was your economist, was it?
It's changed slightly. Mr. Patterson
is teaching tomorrow.
Yeah, so he will be called later. We've got Mr. Lanham here, who is making a submission on behalf of the Central Otago District. I'm just conscious of how much we've got to get through tomorrow, and I have likewise witnesses that have some availability constraints that I'm just trying to manage. So I'm wanting to try and avoid, I suppose, to the extent we can, carrying too much over into tomorrow. So perhaps if Mr. Moore wants to carry on with his cross of Ms. Perkins' evidence, and that would reduce what we needed to cover off tomorrow, or alternatively we perhaps deal with Mr. Lanham this evening, so that's done.
No. Look, if parties have got to be realistic with the sort of hearing that this is. And that is that there may be slippage in time, and parties saying, you know, witnesses, not parties, saying I'm only available on this date, and sorry if you don't make it, I've got a teaching appointment next, you know, tomorrow, is really not helpful. It's something you're not at fault or to blame in any way for that, but it's just not helpful. So there has to be some ability to move within a reasonable time frame, which I would have thought if we can't reach today, then we can reach tomorrow. For most people, we haven't gone more than a half day over, I don't think. So I don't want to interpose another case. This is Lanpro's case, Lanpro's only opportunity, primary opportunity. It may not be the only one yet, but primary opportunity to nail its case. So I don't want to interpose another witness, and your witness can come tomorrow.
Yes, that's fine. I think in that case, if we could carry on a little bit this evening so we get through as much of Lanpro's case today, would be certainly very much appreciated from my point of view.
All right, thank you.
I'm happy to continue. Subject to the caveat, I'd like to read that
carefully overnight. Yeah, no, I understand that. So we're back with Ms. Perkins with you anyway tomorrow morning. Yep.
Yes, thank you.
You had other questions, though.
I do have other questions. I'm going to be heading to your supplementary evidence, which I think was dated the 23rd of March.
Yes.
Now, I just need to find my copy of that, so bear with me. Not where I was anticipating it to be hiding.
Do you want us to give you a copy?
No, I do. I do have it somewhere because I've highlighted it.
Okay.
Here we go. Right, I want to take you to paragraph 17 of that supplementary statement, and in this part of your evidence you're dealing with the non-complying activity pathway, and this paragraph is about providing an extended consent duration for some types of activities. And in particular you have referenced community water supply or hydroelectricity schemes, and noted that a duration of 15, 20 or 25 years is perhaps more appropriate, but you're not sure which of those numbers might be appropriate. I want to start with the hydroelectricity schemes, and I want to stay with the context provided in relation to the schemes that you have described in your paragraph 16.
Sure.
Those are all existing schemes?
Yes.
So in terms of the need for a long duration permit for an existing scheme, what is it In your mind, why is a longer-term permit required to ensure the viability of one of these activities?
I guess when thinking about it, it just gives them some more security that that operation can continue for a longer period. We don't know what's going to come out of the land and water plan and whether that particular activity will be able to continue in the same vein that it has been consented. And I think there's potentially more drivers in the shorter term for something like the primary sector uses, where water is being removed from a catchment entirely and used for irrigation rather than being a, I'm not going to say it's like vaguely non-consumptive, but maybe technically in terms of the interpretation of the word, actually out of the water body for too long to be officially non-consumptive. But those sorts of takes are a lower risk to the environment of continuing for a slightly longer term to give them security that they can continue while other activities may be dealt with in the shorter time frame.
So it's not about the viability of the activity itself, but the infrastructure's already there, isn't it?
The infrastructure is already there. I have not discussed with those parties specifically the viability of 6 years versus longer to understand exactly how their companies or systems operate.
So why is it that those activities should be given security of supply in the long term then?
I'm not suggesting it be a 35-year, as has often been granted in Otago in the past. It's more in consideration of the situation we have found ourselves in as planners at the moment of having all of these applications all at once, and that will be the situation we are in again with a six-year term, that if there are some of those activities that might warrant potentially a longer-term security supply and that might have a lower risk on the environment, then potentially they could have a slightly longer term as part of that transition process.
So in terms of the risk to the environment associated with these types of activities, aren't those the very risks that the new land and water plan is going to be considering?
Yes.
And so isn't it appropriate to allow that plan to come to fruition to set out the allocation framework such that all activities are then consented under it?
Yes, but I don't think that prevents reviews or further consideration of these to be able to occur within that time frame of a consent and that duration that may be granted on it.
So if you think about security of long-term supply, and if your answer to the land and water plan is to say, well, the council can just review the permit and impose the new regime, the security of supply risk is precisely the same, is it not?
Yes, effectively it is.
Except the one point of difference is that it puts the onus on the council to undertake a review, doesn't it?
Yes.
And the council may not be resourced to do that.
Quite possibly not. I'm not sure what the resourcing levels are.
When you're working with consent applicants and you're putting together these applications for fairly significant durations, is my understanding, let's unpack that, you've put together some applications that have been lodged?
I have, yes.
And what? How would you describe the consent terms sought in those applications?
They varied from 6 years to 35 years.
And if you were to weight the range in terms of where the majority of those applications are in terms of durations, where would you say?
I think I need to be clear here, the time with which I've been with LandPro, so that I haven't been responsible for preparing as many as other colleagues at LandPro. So, for example, I prepared the last chance applications, and I've prepared a couple of the Manahirakia ones, but only insofar as to assist with getting them completed, and then assisted with a couple of other shorter term, more recent ones. So to be honest, it's probably only the last chance covered 21 deemed permits, but it was one application. So I would say, reviewed four applications myself.
So remind me, last chance, what was the term sought?
24 years to tie in with the dams that had already been reconsented.
Thank you. I want to move now to the joint witness statement for planning. Now you have a copy of that?
I do.
Very good.
The right one, I think, too.
Take you to paragraph 6. Paragraph 6 to start with. Now, just so that we're clear, your initials there in paragraph 6 are CP.
Yes, that's correct.
And you support the amendments shown in attachment 1.
Yes.
And then paragraph 13, in relation to whether the data period to be used should extend post June 2020, you support the use of all available water metering data.
Yes.
So you're not concerned about applicants ramping up their takes to achieve a single maximum on which to base an application for a controlled activity?
In my opinion, that is a possibility that some applicants could do that. I don't consider that that would be the majority that would do that. Part of my view with this as well is the choice of June 2020. I understand it's sort of somewhat linked to the timing of notification. But some of my thinking in that is that I have some clients who have recently purchased properties. They actually got their irrigation system properly underway only this last season. As it turns out, their history of use from a rate of take point of view and a daily volume point of view won't be any different, but this year they have actually used it across the season far more than the previous owners had. So in that situation, they would be adversely impacted when it was not bad behaviour of trying to ramp up just to secure water as such.
Sure. So in that example, there is a reasonable and logical explanation for the change in the pattern.
Yes.
So wouldn't it be better for that situation to be considered through the restricted discretionary activity rule rather than the controlled activity?
I guess it could be done under both. I think it's just more the security to the applicant of a guaranteed replacement for a short term. In this situation, that applicant has applied for a six-year term but had to seek a non-complying pathway because of the schedule that was notified.
So staying with that example and using the schedule as recommended by the technical experts and also pulled through into the planning statement, how would that application be treated now?
It would probably, if with the way the wording has been included that does not have 2020 as a limit, it would be under a control pathway. It would fall under that pathway, yeah.
Do you see that there could be a risk of some applicants ramping up their takes to achieve a single maximum spike in, say, an instantaneous rate?
It is possible, but I think when you look at the numbers of permits that have already had to lodge replacements as part of the deemed permit process, the numbers you're looking at that are water permits, it's probably, I'm sort of just guessing here in a way, but I wouldn't think it would be as much of a risk because a lot of those permits would have been granted more recently. They're not historic deemed permits where people haven't used their water. I would imagine that they're more likely to be in the last sort of 20 years where people had to put a proper application together to explain what they wanted and how much and why, albeit it's not as comprehensive as they are today. But I can't imagine it would be a significant risk, but yes, you may get a few that are still able to do that.
So when you think about who should bear that risk, is it a choice between the environment versus the abstractor?
I guess by putting it, if that happens, then yes, it would be putting the abstractor above the environment potentially in that situation.
And when you think about the paradigm change brought about in the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, around putting the needs of the water body first. How should that risk be dealt with in the planning framework?
Well, I think at the end of the day, this still would be under a six-year permit, so they're still in a transition phase that would still then get captured under the NPSFM framework following that short-term kind of rollover of the permit, and so further investigation of the application, their efficiency and all of the other aspects in the environment under the new plan could be dealt with at the end of that six-year term. This is not people going for a 20-year permit through that process.
So the risk precisely that I'm asking you about is the risk of applicants ramping up their take ahead of the point in time that their application is processed so as to achieve a higher maximum rate of take to justify a higher grant of consent on renewal, and whether that risk should be borne by the environment or by the abstractor.
I just don't see that there's a huge risk from the number that could be that it could occur under that. I would need to see the numbers that are probably the only way to see it would be to look at the water use records of those permits that are due to expire up to 2025 and their consented rates and look at what the differences are to actually determine what the real level of risk is.
Just so I understand that, are you saying that there simply aren't that many permits out there that have the headroom available within them within which to take at a higher maximum rate, say on a one-off occasion?
I couldn't tell you exactly the number, no.
I want to understand next your opinion in relation to the restricted discretionary activity pathway that's been recommended by some of the planners, and I should caveat that it's not all planners that have recommended that pathway change in the way that the joint witness statement has changed it. So when you think about the restricted discretionary activity that had been put forward by Mr. De Pelsmaker in his 14 March rendition of Plan Change 7, the restricted discretionary pathway applied only to the situation where there was a technical reason as to why data wasn't available. Is that your understanding?
Yes, I'm just going to just quickly have a look at it again, but from my memory, that is the reason that basically there was an issue with the water metering data. There was a technical issue or missing data.
Yes. Now, the version of the RDA that you and some of the other planners recommend has broadened out its application. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And can you explain to me how it's been broadened out to pick up what types of situation?
So I think Ms. Bright mentioned a couple of the types of situations that were sort of discussed as who it might apply to, those parties that haven't had water meters in for as long enough period to actually represent their historical use. So they might have only had a really accurately operating meter for the last 2 or 3 years. They might have had one in place, but I am well aware that there's been a number of issues across Otago with water meters and their accuracy, learning to cope with the climate that we have in terms of, you know, freezing and thaws and the flood flows and flushing flows that come down from the high country takes. So they have had meters in place maybe since they were required to, but they haven't been working very well. So in that situation, you've had a meter in place and it might not be that there's any data missing or that there was necessarily a technical issue, it's just it might not have been the right setup. They wouldn't be captured. Or ones that just had manual records and didn't have a meter until the last couple of years, that's not a technical issue as such. So there was quite a number of potential applicants that might then fall outside, go straight to non-complying, and we thought that there needed to be a pathway for those. We did, however, note that we didn't want to allow for just those people that went, water meter regulations, can't be bothered putting in a water meter, not going to do it. Those people that have clearly flouted the rules, we catered for the fact that there needed to have been a water meter put in place so that they had to have actually committed to some metering and regulation of their take and not just the ones that just didn't want to put something in. So they wouldn't be able to be captured by this.
And when you think about the restricted discretionary activity, do you still consider that ought only to enable volumes and rates of take that reflect historical use?
Yes, it's just to reflect historical use.
And so the other relevant methods referred to within matter of discretion A shouldn't be used in a manner that seeks to elevate or increase above historical use?
No.
And insofar as there might be a risk of that occurring, that risk should be dealt with in the drafting?
Yes, if other interpretations of the way that's been drafted view it such that, you know, with a legal interpretation that that's not the way it could be interpreted, then that's not the intention. The intention was always that it reflects historical use, but that there might need to be other information be able to be put forward to further explain what was historically taken if those water meter records don't give you enough picture.
And when you look at the wording then that's been recommended and the phrase that I've highlighted is "and other relevant methods and data," do you accept that's a very broad phrase?
It is, and we spent a number of hours going over this and I don't think we ever managed to reach, we just didn't have time to take it any further. The intention there is that it is relatively broad, so we didn't think you could effectively go through and list every single possible type of data that could be used off the top of our heads, potentially with more time and more investigation that could happen. But in that time frame, there was no way of us getting an exhaustive list that could capture everything.
Do you see that there could be a risk with the way that this matter of discretion is currently worded, that an applicant might choose to apply under the RDA and point to, for example, the Aqualink guidelines as an other method and say, well, that's another method that shows what my historical use could be? Is the wording here tight enough?
The wording allows for something like Aqualink to be used as part, but I don't think you could just... I think it's tight enough that it couldn't be just Aqualink, because it does still have to be within the limits of historical use as established through these methods. So the within the limits of historical use is still set aside as the initial part of that matter.
And this is perhaps where the challenge arises in terms of using the likes of an Aqualink model to demonstrate what historical use is, because that's not what Aqualink does it?
No, it tells you what is needed for your property at any, you know, for 9 out of 10 years. So no, I recognise that, and I don't think that just having Aqualink would be sufficient. And I think, because we did discuss this and considered that, well, it's still a full matter of discretion. It's not a matter of control, and you have to grant consent under it. The council still have full discretion here that they can, it can be properly evaluated. We're still talking about a 6-year term. Recognising we don't want people to increase beyond their historic use, but there's a substantial amount of additional work if an applicant wants to go down this pathway as opposed to the controlled activity, when really the only difference is that their water metering records don't accurately reflect historic use, because that's the only real difference in this RDA rule as opposed to the controlled activity rule.
Right, I have some questions now for you about the recommendations that you have made in terms of changes to Plan Change 7. And the version that I'm reading from is the version that you've attached to your supplementary statement of evidence.
Yes.
Now, I'm a little unclear as to precisely what your opinion actually is in terms of the provisions of the plan change, and that's perhaps a reflection of the fact that this thing has moved iteratively along the way, and you've also participated in some conferencing, so
sure.
It may well be that some of the drafting you'd put forward in your appendix you've moved on from,
yep,
as a result of the conferencing, so
sure.
You might need to tell me where that has actually occurred. And in fact, I'll start with that. That might be a more efficient way to do it. In terms of that which you've recommended and attached to your supplementary evidence, what have what changes would you now be recommending in light of the conferencing that's occurred?
So I would recommend that policy 10A21 have the retain the points C and E in their amended form.
Just pause with me. 10A21 retain
C and E in their amended form from the planners JWS. So that's the reflecting the historic rate of take.
Sorry, are you now wanting to? I can't see a C or I can't see a C. Is there a C there?
It may look like an E because it's.
Is it there is no increase in actual instantaneous?
Yes.
Okay, so that's the C. So you recommend that that be retained?
Retained in its amended form from the planners JWS. So it, which is that there is no increase in historical instantaneous rate, I think.
But what you're wanting to do is to put in words from the planners.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to get really confusing if we're just going through point by point now, changing, keeping points. I mean, I've kind of made a couple of notes on to that effect for that. It's mainly to that policy, to be fair. And I would remove my added in B that's in highlights.
Where do you want to go with this? I mean, I understand why you're asking, because, like, I was a little surprised that planners got into the objectives, policies and rules, but, you know, there they go. And I thought they were just dealing with the schedule.
As I had.
But they didn't. They got into the objectives and policies and rules. And so I'm a bit like you. I don't know. This is the conundrum. I know that you and the previous witness liked a discretionary activity rule, but that doesn't appear in the JWS for planners. If you were still thinking about, if you were getting into those provisions, you would have gone, yeah, let's have a discretionary activity rule, or you would have, you know what I mean, to be comprehensive. So what the JWS looks like is that you've actually retreated from your March supplementary, but that might not be correct.
No, so that's not correct. So we, whilst there was movement into those policies and objectives in that planners conferencing, at the time we all felt that the changes made to the schedule needed to have those reflective changes in those parts of the policies, and so we did only limit the changes that anyone would suggest or recommend as they related back to the questions that arose out of the technical conferencing and then the changes that were subsequently required to the schedule. So I appreciate that it then looks really confusing because there's yet another version of the plan change sitting out there, and it doesn't incorporate the other changes that someone like myself or Ms. Dicey might also still want to see. We did note, I know with Mr. Twos, that things like the community water supply, they may still seek for that to be completely not included within PC7, and we did note that in the conferencing, but that we proceeded on the basis that if it was included, this would be the types of changes that would be required and agreed upon for something like community water supply. So it was difficult to try and separate things out, but we did try and keep it to, as related to the schedule, but some things came backwards.
Okay.
I'm struggling to figure out which version of Plan Change 7 the witness is now pursuing.
Well, I think it would be the JWS version plus a discretionary activity rule. Is that right?
Effectively, yes.
That's right.
And some sort of long-term pathway rule.
Some sort of long-term pathway rule. And I mean, I don't know in that... I reckon I have a view about this, that non-complying activities... the non-complying activity rule is not your alternate to a discretionary activity. It's just not. It's not conceptually how I view the two forms of activity. So you've got you want plus discretionary pathway, and I don't know whether or not you were going to add any changes to the non-complying policy provision, assuming that it stands on its own legs.
Yes, I think I would need to do some more work on this, because from the changes and just the change in thinking that's happened through the planners JWS and the changes to the RDA pathway, I don't... And to be fair, I didn't try and redraft another discretionary version. I took what Ms. Dicey had said and put that instead, something, you know, something like this, without trying to confuse matters with yet more versions. If it's helpful, I can like pair that back to more what I might word it as.
Well, I don't know. It should be in your evidence, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I did note that this was taken as hers, and generally the intention of that. I supported the intention of that without rewording further and further, but I can do that for you if you'd like overnight.
I think it should be in your evidence, actually. Why would it not be in your evidence already? I thought you adopted what Ms. Dicey.
I effectively have adopted what Ms. Dicey's, Ms. Dicey
said. So in a sense, it is in your evidence.
Yes.
And it stands and falls with the cross-examination.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess my suggestion only related to taking the things out of the JWS planning that had gone on after the various groups had looked at the scheduling and they'd taken it a step further, that if we could have a version that made that clear in terms of this witness, only those things that came out of the planning conference and where this witness was sitting, it might be a better use of the back end of the afternoon than struggling through each line. Mm. That was my only suggestion.
I mean, this. I guess what you don't know what needs also to go in, if you like, to that JWS, if that's now the template that we're working from. Mm. Ms. Dicey's policy.
Yes,
and maybe something to do with non-complying activities.
Yes, and what I have in front of me is the version attached to the supplementary evidence of 23 March, which has the, I'll call it the Ms. Dicey discretionary policy plus the Ms. Dicey discretionary rule.
Yeah.
And I was not super clear as to whether this witness was still pursuing on the same terms this framework or not. And I think the witness is.
Yes, I would still like to see that. I still recommend that path. There be a pathway like that in there.
And I have some questions about that.
Oh, you should ask those.
Which I will pursue that.
You should ask those. And then I think there's this big question about non-complying activity policy and rule, and what's the go there?
Yes, in terms of looking at what's changed in... Yeah, I'm unclear as to where this witness is
standing
now going
too?
With that.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So that's all a lot of elements then. There's the first one to do with the conference, three lots of conferencing we had in the planning one, which is where you started. So I just wondered if there was some cut through we could get on that so that you didn't have to lead out, do you agree with this one, do you agree with that one?
Yeah,
I mean, it may be clear reading the JWS, but it's quite hard to deal with provisions on that basis, isn't it?
What would make my job a whole lot easier would be an amended version of the Plan Change 7 attached to the supplementary evidence that has this witness's current position in terms of the changes which she's recommending be made to Plan Change 7. And then I can cross her on that. Now, that may be a reasonably straightforward exercise in terms of tracking into this version the differences, and they may not be significant. I don't know. And whether that could be done overnight and circulated, that might speed things up in the morning.
Yeah, so I can effectively, because I know what's critically missing from the supplementary evidence version is an RDA pathway, and I do recommend that be in there as we agreed at the planner's joint witness statement. So that's obviously not in the supplementary, because that wasn't part, that's something that's come post the supplementary through the planner's joint witness. So yes, what is in one or the other alone don't accurately reflect my exact position, so I can see the difficulties you're having.
All right. Well, I wonder whether, could that be prepared overnight?
I could do that overnight,
And have that circulated, and I'd use that as the basis for then stepping through the provisions, which I think I still need to do.
You do? Yeah. Okay. All right, well, that, I know it's homework, but it sounds like it's relatively straightforward. If you continue to support what Ms. Dicey said, we'll continue to have a view on the non-complying pathway and what that looks like. And I actually don't remember what your original, what your supplementary said in relation to that. They can be brought forward into the JWS document. Have you got that in Word format? You should do.
Yes, I think it was circulated. I will double check. Otherwise, I think it was sent through to Michelle. So.
Mm. Okie dokie. Do you want to call it quits now?
Yeah, I think we should sensibly do so.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. So that means you remain in your oath, so you can't talk about this case to anyone. And if you could do that homework and perhaps email Frieda the document so we can get it printed off. When do you think you'll have that done by?
Well, if I do it tonight, then it should be able to be circulated before I turn the lights off tonight rather than trying to do it in the morning. So,
yeah, no, that'll be good. It's just that council needs to prepare his questions, but he's it got would, something yeah. to go on. You mean you're following the Ms. Dicey direction.
Ms. Dicey plus some of the planners JWS stuff pulled in, so
it
will expand out a little bit because of that. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. So as soon as we get that, if you you know how to circulate it too, so circulate it to the court so it can be printed as well as all of the other parties.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's us. And do we need to start at 9 to get a push on? Yep. Okay, good. We'll start at 9 o'clock.
Please all stand.
Gary, you would have heard all of our questions to Ms. Dicey and also to Ms. Brighton. You might want to cut through to the chase and think about concrete examples of deemed permits and think about the court's minutes. The question of is there a policy gap? How might it be filled if it is not just simply to repeat as a mantra and deemed permits? Because I bet you that's not going to mean much in 5 years' time, though it's just, to me, it's... So we're assuming that there is a pathway, either because we can create a pathway under the RMA or because there is a path, the statutory creature can somehow survive. Do we need to do it? Why do we need to do it? No more anecdotal evidence from anybody. We need good concrete examples. Can they operate by themselves? Do they need to operate in tandem with watershed agreements? We listen to this evidence and we wonder whether there's just simply a marketplace for water out there. And that's what we're grappling with, is that farmers seem to have the market. That's a crude way of putting it. Or maybe there's some social licensing that goes on out there. But if there is, and that is important, how do we reflect it? Yeah. And Ms. Baker-Galloway is nodding. Mr. Moore looks quite quizzical, as if that's a sickening thought, but it might be one you need to grapple with. What's the reality out there? And what is the likelihood of any adverse impact on other abstractors, I think, first and foremost, but also the environment, secondly, if these things aren't brought forward?
Perhaps explain that differently to ensure that those things are not precluded. Seem to be happening anyway without.
I know, because there's a market and people are regulating themselves. Now, I know I should never use that word in the context of water, but there is a lot of regulation already happening. So do we need to step into the frame?
Maybe or maybe not. It's a good question.
Yeah. So difficult question also for you, Ms. Irving. Do we need to step up, or do we go, I bet you the Valley will do something about this when it comes to the exercise of consents?
Yeah, it's like catching a cloud in a way, I think, because every catchment
is doing
something different. So there's no one answer about whether people are exercising priorities or not. Even within a single catchment, some may be, some may be not. And so to try and encapsulate that in a matter of discretion on a rule or is really hard. And
so how is it echoed? Does it need to be echoed in this plan, and how is it echoed?
Yeah.
Such that the direction to this marketplace is set by the regional plan. And I know that's really poor choice of language, there being a market as to water, but it seems to me that there's a lot of non-regulatory, it's not so much control, but non-regulatory flow sharing mechanisms afoot. So how is that echoed in a way that can be carried over? If there isn't a full term, consent. Because that's the risk, you know, we take. If there isn't one and you haven't actually got a good case in place, how are we, what is the signal to that marketplace? Is that a problem or not a problem, that the signal is, there's an absence of signalling in the plan? I don't know. What I do know is that I'm not sure how to, yet, that we've got a clear idea as to what our potential tools are.
In some ways, I feel that the existing regional plan water has had quite a few signals in it about its expectations of water users, and certainly they have heeded those signals and begun moving. So it's, I think, a question of the extent to which they can be retooled for a transitional regime. But I think the ease of that isn't going to be universally applicable because, as I think has been described by a number of the witnesses, in some ways the retooling has been done in anticipation of the renewals with its associated limits. Mm. And so in those contexts, the water sharing anticipates an extra piece of the puzzle which we're not adding in through the controlled activity pathway. And other examples, and I think the Falls Dam agreement, you know, that is a more concrete example that has been working and that there's some structure around. So it's horses for courses in different catchments, different sub-catchments, which makes it really hard to draft a rule that...
And it may not be a rule, it may be a matter of consideration.
Yeah.
Either on a controlled, presumably on a controlled, that's the easiest pathway if people want to avail themselves of that. Or RDA, I think I said in the minute. But you may have policy, it could well be retooling or repurposing policy signals which are already there. They're already signals, if you like, to the community. Then with them being picked up again in non-regulatory methods. After all, that's how people are organising themselves anyway, and that's without new consents. The potential for, you know, that's with the current situation. They are living there or organising their lives that way. And so that's what the controlled activity rules kind of pick up and echo back.
I think one of the challenges perhaps from the council side is traditionally they've taken a very hands-off approach to that water sharing regime, and it's a question of whether that continues to be a sustainable way of dealing with that.
It might be. In the absence, it might be. I don't know. It might be for 6 years and then thereafter not. Yeah. Okay. Still a lot of thinking, I think, and be looking forward to your responses. You know, do you send policy signals as council has done under the operative plan? And, you know, can you pick those signals up? Should you pick those signals up in matters of control and matters of discretion? Should you not even do that? Just you're sending a policy signal and let the community organise itself, because it has organised itself for the last 30 years, in fact, the last 100 years. Yeah.
I have been giving it some thought, and I can give you some hopefully some help tomorrow, but I will signal that I haven't personally dealt with priorities on any permits that I've looked at, so I can't give you anything more helpful on that, and I don't think it would be helpful if I'm just taking you through generic answers. So I personally haven't dealt with priorities.
But that's helpful to know.
I have given some thought as to one way that you might be able to include them, which I can talk you through tomorrow, but I haven't, can't put an exact example in place for you because I just haven't had that experience.
Good. All right. No. It's good to know you're off the hook to that extent. All right. Thank you. So we're adjourned through to 9 o'clock. You're right with 9? Yeah. Adjourned through to 9 o'clock tomorrow.
Please all stand.